News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Here's to Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, here's to your health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. John Saltz about your personal physician. Does it make a difference?
I sure hope it makes a difference because I've got one.
That's right. Well, first we're going to talk about some research that matters. Our very first article is about falls.
Yeah, you know, Christy, we occasionally talk about ways of preventing falls. And this is a really interesting article that came out of Yale University School of Medicine in the Journal of the American Medical Association, really helping us understand, you know, what do we really know about falls and what can we really do to maybe prevent them even better?
Yeah, so we know falls are common. And this is an article that focused on older adults who live in the community and how we can tease out the risk factors for falls and how to intervene to prevent falls.
Yeah, and they talk about, you know, some of the interventions that have been shown, and we've talked about some of them on the show, include things like, you know, exercise programs and physical therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Some things we haven't talked about, but, you know, cataract surgery, I think, to help so you can see where you're going, as well as reducing medications, mm-hmm. and something we haven't talked about as much as maybe we should.
And along with vitamin D supplementation, that's really the strongest evidence we have to prevent fractures in older men is by taking vitamin D supplementation. And the other thing in this article they teased out a little bit were what are the strongest risk factors for fall. So things like having a previous fall or having problems with strength or gait or balance or being on many medications.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, Christy, I think I take home from this is it's really worthwhile scheduling an appointment with your doctor.
Absolutely.
As we're getting older to really talk about falls prevention. This is one of those things that an ounce of prevention really would be worth a pound of cure, in this case, a pound of a fracture avoidance.
Yeah, I recently had a patient do this with me, and I had him bring his son in. So we could really talk about the house, how it's set up. We could go through and really look at his medication list and try to reduce the risk for him having a fall. And I think that's a great idea, Adam. I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, let's talk about our next article, Christy. And this is one of those bombs that went off around the world, certainly around the United States, and it happened just recently about prostate-specific antigen testing, PSA testing, as well as digital rectal examinations for male patients over a certain age.
Yeah, so this was an updated prostate cancer screening guideline that was put out by the American Cancer Society. And this is really the first time since 2001 that there's been an update in those prostate cancer screening guidelines.
Yeah, you know, we've known for a while now that the evidence really that doing PSA tests for many, if not most, men who don't have risk factors for prostate cancer, there are lots of false positives in the test, and there's lots of costs from doing those biopsies. And so there's some questions have been, is it really beneficial to people?
And I think the fact that prostate cancer in some groups can be very slow growing. And so you hear that mantra, more people die with prostate cancer than from it. And so is it helpful for someone to know that they have it if maybe that could cause harm, if the cancer itself may not hurt them? So this is a recommendation, a group of cancer screening guidelines that really makes a stronger case for informed decision-making, for conversations between the doctor and the patient about the pros and cons of having the screening done at all.
Yeah, you know, and this is reported in the paper, Christy, it was like, you know, we should quit doing PSA tests on people and we should quit doing a digital rectal examination. As one of my male patients who recently actually had a prostate cancer picked up early on by a PSA test said, well, so you don't do anything then to try to diagnose prostate cancer? I said, well, if you take this to its conclusion, we don't have any test that they conclusively say can benefit. But I think you're right. This is about actually having an informed decision. What would go into that discussion?
Well, into that discussion would be a history, so finding out a little bit about the age of the person, their other medical problems, their family history, if they have prostate cancer at a young age in their family. So a real conversation at first and about how concerned are they about prostate cancer.
Yeah, and the problem here, Christy, is that these elements that they say that that we should have with patients includes talking about the screening test and how good it does, whether or not it actually helps or not. What about the treatment and the side effects of the treatment? What about biopsy? What about false positive, false negative? You know,
it would take hours to explain all this.
It would take hours. And I'm like, okay, you don't really recognize what it's like to be under pressure to see a patient and to do this as one of 20 other things one is doing in the exam room. So they are talking about decision aids in videos and this information. But I think we're a long way from really being able to do this effectively.
I would agree with you. I think it's easier for us to just say, now it's time for your test, and not have the conversation or to sway them against them without really allowing the patient to fully understand the risks and the benefits. But it also had some things in there about reducing the PSA for people who do decide to take the PSA screening test, that potentially reducing that interval to every other year if they have a low PSA level. So I also liked that there's, you know, some promotion of a conversation involving the patient and then thinking about, well, really, how often do we have to do this if they're choosing to go down that road?
Right. Kind of like we started cutting back a little bit on how often we did pap smears on women. And so maybe these are some refinements in the guidelines that can help make them more effective, if not even more cost effective.
Mm-hmm. I just hope they could come up with a way for us to explain it a little more simply.
Difficult. Well, these last two research that matters are really in the news things that matter, Christy. And I guess we were both kind of, you know, we've been overwhelmed, I'm sure, as many listeners have been, about this pace of healthcare reform and the changes. And in many respects, the apathy that appears to have set in this country about what is a real, continuing, serious, major health problem.
Well, our first article to touch on that today is from the New York Times, and this is an article about how we ask questions in polls and how we frame it. And so the question, the leading question for this article is healthcare reform A, a bad idea, B, a really bad idea, or C, a totally despicable idea?
Well,
shocking to read that.
I like that headline because it really framed what I think is really a central issue here that we're facing, which is how do we really understand what's happening, and how is that understanding of what's happening being framed by the questions and the way people are phrasing the questions? I mean, whatever has happened to the question of what do we want to do about the you know, 20 to 30 million Americans that have no health insurance, or actually it's more than that, 46 million no health insurance or underinsured, what are we doing?
Well, and even just thinking about, you know, the way the news is presented to us, that there's a poll, you know, there was a New York Times poll that found 66% of Americans supported the public option, and then Time magazine saying it was 56%, and then Fox News saying 44%. But really, you can't compare those numbers. You can't say it necessarily is changing over time if the wording of the question is so very different. I mean, how you phrase that question drastically results how a person may answer that.
And whatever you use in the beginning, you know, are you concerned about the 46 million Americans with no or under health insurance? You know, if you ask it that way, yeah,
sure.
Everyone's concerned about this versus, and are you in favor of a policy when people don't even understand what the policy is? It makes it exceedingly difficult. And so I think increasingly we're getting removed from some of the real issues here. And I guess that gets us into the very last article, which was another commentary in the New York Times about the recent healthcare summit that President Obama had with the Democrats and the Republicans there on Capitol Hill.
Yeah. So the article was just about how much posturing there was between the Democrats and the Republicans, between their different stances, and just the lack of being able to actually have a conversation, because everyone, I mean, and this is the thing that turns me off. Honestly, I want to be invested. I care about the future of our country. But when the politicians are so stuck in their politics that they can't actually move forward, it's disheartening. It really is.
Well, and it seems like there are so many things here that if we get down to it, that our listeners and we would agree need to be done.
Right.
Things like eliminating pre-existing condition clauses so that people can't get insurance who have been diagnosed with cancer or other serious medical problems.
Right. That we should boil it down to the things we actually can agree on and move forward.
You know, anything that can provide increased access to people who otherwise would have no access. These are the sort of things that I think that the great majority of people, if we said let's agree on the 3 to 5 things, then we could move forward at least on those, and at least people could feel a sense of confidence that some people are going to get better from this legislation.
Mm-hmm. Well, that we've had a chance to talk about several different things in research that matters, including a little bit on healthcare reform and some about polls and surveys and how those are done and how we ask the question really influencing the results of those.
Something about really the recent PSA guidelines and the recognition that these are really hard to do informed, but we will do our best to have that type of informed decision making.
And about falls and how we can prevent them.
Well, that's going to conclude the Research That Matter portions of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll talk with Dr. John Saltz about your personal physician. Does it make a difference? We certainly hope so. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about your personal physician. Does it make a difference? And, you know, I know it's true for both Adam and for me, and it's true of most family physicians, that we choose this line of work because forming and developing and sustaining those relationships with patients and with their families is something that's really important to us. And as we're thinking about healthcare reform and trying to rethink the way we care for patients across America, this is a great conversation for us to have. Does it make a difference to have a personal physician?
Yeah, Christy and I have done a lot of reading and stories and research over the last few weeks about telemedicine and other ways of delivering medical care. And so it'll open up all kinds of questions today with our guest, Dr. John Saltz. Dr. Saltz is a professor and chairman of the Department of Family Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University. He received his BS and MD degrees from Ohio State University before completing a family medicine residency program at Dwight David Eisenhower Army Medical Center and a faculty development fellowship at UNC Chapel Hill. Nice to hear that. Dr. Saltz is the author of 3 books and over 100 journal articles and book chapters, and his current research interests include this what we call continuity of care in the doctor-patient relationship, medical decision-making, and the future of family medicine. And I think what we're talking about today about a personal physician and what we know about it is really important to those conversations. So thank you so much, Dr. Saltz, for joining us as a guest today.
You're welcome.
You know, Dr. Saltz, one of the things that Adam and I love to start with is to hear a bit about your story. How did you come to pass, and how did you get to this place where a relationship with patients and thinking about the future of that doctor-patient relationship has become such an area of passion for you?
Well, I grew up in a small town in Ohio that still has only one traffic light. And I was the first person in my family to go to medical school, and I'm the only person anywhere in any of the generations that's been a physician. And so I grew up understanding a small town doctor. I went to the same doctor from the time I can remember until I graduated from high school and went off to college. And it was a family doctor that everybody in town saw. And so my concept of medicine growing up was this person that was sort of there for all of these life events. And I kind of went into medicine thinking that that's the sort of physician that I'd want to be. When you get into medical school, this whole world of medicine opens before you. There's all these different specialties and subspecialties. There's all kinds of incredibly interesting things to study. But for me, it kept coming back to, well, what sort of doctor do we really need for small towns and rural communities in the United States? And that really has to be somebody that can take care of most things that are common. It has to be somebody that people can really trust and get to know over time. And it turns out that we're not always really, really good at making enough doctors like that. So I got pretty interested early in my career in academic medicine, because although I can't really be a medical school professor in a town the size that I grew up in, I can feel pretty good about the fact that I've trained hundreds and hundreds of people who practice in towns like that. And I think that's a really important value that shouldn't get lost.
Well, you know, one of the things that I hear from my patients frequently, Dr. Saltz, is you know, and this is whether it's in Chapel Hill or when I go home to Atlanta and family members, and I imagine it's not much different in Oregon and in major cities across the country, is the real need to have an advocate for them, someone who is an advocate. And I think in most cases, it has to be a personal physician, a healthcare advocate. And I wonder if you can speak to, you know, when you talk about continuity of care, what do you mean by that? And is that only that you're not limiting that to patients who need physicians only in rural areas?
No, not at all. I think what I became interested in as I got into my career as a researcher is what causes doctor-patient relationships to endure over time? Why is it that certain patients seek out and connect to certain doctors? And what makes those relationships successful? Now, not every patient in the world wants to have a doctor that they get to know really well. And there's lots of doctors who I presume don't care very much about seeing the same patients over and over again. They're much more interested in the illness that the patient has or the episode of care that they're taking care of. But there's a lot of people who very much want to have a physician that can kind of specialize and pay attention to them and really get to know them over time and feel like that transcends. So I became very interested in what evidence is there that people receive better care when that happens? Who are the patients who want to be in these long-term relationships with doctors, and what are the building blocks of those relationships? Because I felt like if I could understand that really well, then it would be easier to teach people to be in that sort of a role. And it turns out that this is a pretty universal phenomena. It's not just in rural America. It's not just in urban America. It's really in just about every place that healthcare gets delivered.
Yeah, how about outside of America?
Every place that healthcare gets delivered in the world, to my knowledge, a sense of trust and responsibility in this relationship is at the root of what causes healing to happen. And so trying to understand how to build those, we're like, what can the doctor do to make these relationships the most likely to happen?
So what are those things? I mean, Adam and I are involved in teaching young doctors, young family doctors who want to have these relationships, presumably, and certainly our residents do. But what are those building blocks?
So some of them are things that you might not expect. I think it's important that the doctor is broadly trained. Mm-hmm. Because if you want to have a relationship that endures over time, then you have to have a high likelihood of being able to solve whatever problem comes to you. It doesn't work to just take care of one particular disease because people don't have one disease all the time. And so to transcend across time, you have to have a breadth of skills. I think secondly, you have to have you have to care about these relationships. You mentioned that the two of you care a lot about having these sorts of relationships with your patients. It turns out that there's lots of doctors who do. But if you really, really care about connecting with patients and you put energy into connecting them, you need to know that creates a very satisfying practice for you. These continuity practices correlate with physician satisfaction and physician retention in the place where they're practicing as strong as anything else, more strongly than how the doctor's paid, actually.
Wow. So what do you mean about, because you would think that, well, I'm going to see you as a patient, I'm going to be your doctor, and when you come in, you know, you can see me and I'll see you and we'll live happily ever after. But it sounds like there's more of a science to this for how to really make this happen, and then some pitfalls for where it goes off.
Sure. So we've done some research about the nature of the relationships that last a long time. And we had some hypotheses going into this research. So one hypothesis was a relationship lasts a long time because nothing ever happened that caused it to break up. You know, you stay married for a long time because you never meet anybody else. Right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Most of us who are married don't think that we stay married because we haven't met anybody else.
Sure.
There's something more to it than that. But another hypothesis was that there are certain things the doctor does that get this to happen, or there's certain things the patient's seeking to get it to happen. It turns out that a good bit of the building blocks are critical events that happen in the relationship. times when the doctor was there for the patient or did something extra or called when they didn't need to or made a house call or visited the patient in the nursing home or convened the family to talk about a terminal illness. Times where you transcend what is sort of a clinical relationship into a personal relationship, and the patient believes that you care about them.
Can that occur during an individual visit? So in other words, those are things that occur external to an individual visit. What about within an individual encounter? Are those same principles at stake? So if you ask about and understand what's happening with your patient's children, does that also help?
So you're referring to interacting during the visit and collecting and finding out more about the person as a person as
yes.
opposed to the disease. Well, healthcare should be about people, not about the diseases they have. One of my very favorite quotes and from the very early days of family medicine, an educator out in California named Don Ransom, said that what we were trying to do in family medicine was to eradicate the notion that the patient was a dirty window through which the doctor views the disease. Because in a lot of medical education, we teach patients that the disease is what they, that we teach doctors that the disease is what they need to master, and the patient is what they is the vessel that carries the disease around. But that's not the healing relationship. The healing relationship is about the person who has the disease. And we always have to remember to be great physicians. It's about taking care of people who have diseases, not diseases that afflict people.
Absolutely. Wow. Absolutely. Well, you know, Dr. Saltz, we need to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. John Saltz, about your personal physician. Does it make a difference? We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Here's to Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. John Saltz on the topic of your personal physician. Does it make a difference? And we were having a beautiful conversation about the building blocks of, from a physician's point of view, of how to create that doctor-patient relationship. And I'm interested in also something you alluded to earlier about the evidence for better care that patients receive when they have a personal physician. I'm really reminded from conversations with my own family where they think, you know, if I have a heart problem, I go to the cardiologist. If I have, you know, a GYN problem, I go to the gynecologist. And these conversations about, no, if you really have a relationship with one doctor who can coordinate that, that you do receive better care. What do we know about that from an evidence standpoint, and how do you explain that and engage patients in that way?
Well, from an evidence standpoint, a good bit of my research has been studying what's the relationship between care outcomes and care cost when patients are in long-term relationships with an individual provider versus moving from provider to provider. And I think the evidence is quite strong that outcomes are better and costs are lower when patients are in that sort of trusting relationship. Now, these are mostly correlation studies, and that means we know that being in a relationship like this is correlated with better quality and lower cost. It's very hard to say that it's a cause-effect relationship. To do that, you'd have to take people who weren't in relationships like this and force them into it to find out whether they got better.
Sure.
And we don't have a system that works like that. So we know that they correlate. I think people commonly have this perception that if nothing much is wrong with you and all you need is preventive care, you can go to a generalist, a family doctor, a general pediatrician, general internist. If you're really sick and have a problem, you should go to somebody who specializes in that problem. the data shows that well people go to generalist and that sick people go to specialist and generalist. Because it turns out that most people, 80% of Americans with a chronic illness, have more than one of them. And the minute you have more than one and you have two different subject matter specialists dealing with you, all kinds of conflict can happen about whether the medicines that they're prescribing are banging heads with one another, whether or not the overall care is being balanced with the care of each individual problem. So I think the evidence is really pretty strong that people who are in these relationships have better outcomes at a lower cost, and therefore we should promote them. But how to promote them, how to get your listeners to understand why this would be beneficial to them, or how to get your parents to understand that, that's a somewhat different deal. Because, you know, I wouldn't presume to think that every single patient would want to have this kind of relationship with their doctor. Some people don't like a lot of intimacy. They want to go see a doctor to answer a specific question, and, you know, they don't... I don't presume to think that every single patient wants a relationship like this. The data are that people do better at lower cost when they do.
You know, we're talking with Dr. John Saltz about the benefits and the outcomes of having a personal physician. And, you know, it reminded me, Dr. Saltz, about a patient I had recently who sees a cardiologist for some significant heart issues, but also the cardiologist, by virtue of them being an internist, initially does a fair amount of primary care for the patient. The patient said to me, well, do I need to come see you again? I said, well, there are a lot of things that that provider doesn't do for you. They don't do comprehensive skin examinations. They don't do prostate examinations. They don't think about a lot of the other screening things that you may need. And I came up with a whole host of things. And after that conversation, the patient really had a better understanding and appreciation of the role that I provided. But I wonder, what are the threats? What are the external threats driving this conversation to maybe threaten continuity of care? Because it seems like everyone want to have Dr. Marcus Welby or the Mrs. Dr. Marcus Welby, you know, as their provider. Why, you know, but that's not the case.
Well, I think that we live in a very mobile society, and both doctors and patients move around from community to community a lot. We also live in a very medically mobile society. Our employers change insurance companies. Our insurance companies contract with different doctors. And there's disruption in these relationships that may not have anything to do with anybody being unhappy with each other. It may have to do with just the mobility of our society and the changes in sort of this giant marketplace that medicine has become. More and more of the health plans in the northwest part of the country understand that disrupting doctor-patient relationships costs them money because tests get repeated, mm-hmm. and medication errors occur when people move from one system to the next.
The fifth CAT scan for headaches because it's the fifth physician who didn't have access to the other records.
Precisely. And of course, this was one of the areas of research that I got the most interested in. If we had perfect information sharing from practices, would having a personal physician still matter? And I think the answer is yes, it would, even if I had perfect information. Because when I have conversations with patients I've been taking care of for a decade, their ability to trust and be comfortable with the advice I'm giving them is at a completely different level than people I'm meeting the first time. We've been through a lot together, and they trust my motives, but they trust my competence. And they know that if they have that headache that really does need a neurosurgeon, I'm going to get the neurosurgeon for them and help them pick the right one. That role of helping them navigate through a system that not only has become increasingly complicated and expensive, but is increasingly dangerous, I think that's more important now than it's ever been. It's not a throwback to Marcus Welby. Marcus Welby didn't have a health system anything near as complex as this in the 1960s when he was on TV.
You know, thinking about healthcare reform, and, you know, it's hard to crystal ball, but from your perspective, if there were one or two things that we actually achieved in healthcare reform to promote this relationship, what would those things be?
Well, I think that what we're focusing on in Oregon, and what I think a lot of places, I know you are working on this a lot in North Carolina too, is the notion of creating primary care settings that are highly accessible, highly personal, and very well coordinated and efficient compared to what we've been used to in the past. And, you know, we're a lot of people are using the term patient-centered medical homes for this or patient-centered primary care homes for this. The idea of being able to pick who you want to have providing your care and have that person available to you whenever you need them. Most people think that that's lost in American medicine, and I don't think it needs to be. I think we're with the kind of communication and information technology we have today, we can deliver the doctor you want when you want him or her. It's just a matter of organizing the practice and compensating for that care in a way that isn't all driven by office visits all the time.
Well, I know that we're going to have to wrap in a second, but I want to ask one last question. Is there, you know, we've been talking about what we can do as providers to really provide this service in a better way. And I know we do this, try to do this at UNC Family Medicine and try to lead in this like you in Oregon on the other side of the coast. But what's the role for patients? Are there one or two things that patients can do that or our listeners that can do that can help doctors such as Christy and I provide the service even better than we currently do?
Well, I think the first advice I'd give to people is don't settle for less than what you could get. You do not have to choose between medical competence and personal intimacy. You can have both of those things if they matter to you. You need to look for a doctor real seriously. A lot of people put more energy into picking who cuts their hair than who their physician is. And I suppose that's okay if nothing's wrong with you and you go to the doctor once every couple of years for a checkup. But when you become ill or when an injury happens and you're scared, you really want to know that you've got somebody in your corner that will stick up for you and that person is competent and expert in understanding your problem. I don't think it's a choice between family doctors and specialists. I think you should be able to have all of the competencies that go with both of those things. And I think the biggest thing that's lacking in my community is most patients have long ago given up that that's possible for them.
Hmm. So maybe Christy and I can encourage our listeners and patients out there to say, be an advocate for yourself, what it is that you want, need, and express that, and perhaps listen to how the physician responds to that. And if the physician responds in a way that indicates they want to do that, you've got a good head start.
I think so.
Well, thank you so much. We've been really had a wonderful conversation with Dr. John Saltz of the Oregon Health Sciences University Department of Family Medicine about what really clearly does make a difference, the value of having a primary physician, primary continuity of care. And thank you so much for being our guest and the research that you're doing.
Thank you, Dr. Saltz.
You're welcome.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. For House Call segment of our show today, we're going to talk about your health questions, experiences, and attitudes.
And we want you to write us about your experiences and give us your questions, and we'll try to address these on an upcoming show. Please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And now we'll have our executive producer, Julie Steiner, read some of the questions we have today. Julie?
Our first listener writes, I have a 12-year-old son who was diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder. When we were told this, our hearts went down 3 notches. But after we talked about it with our doctor, our hearts went back up, as we have hope for what has been an awful few years, not knowing what was wrong with him. Please talk about this some on your show so others can know more about this condition.
Well, thank you so much for writing in this particular question, because I think what you just described that is one of the things people need to know. This is a difficult psychiatric condition for which people go a long time before it's diagnosed, and it's incredibly difficult on the family, and knowing a little bit about it makes you feel a little bit better. So we can talk a little bit about that today.
Yeah, and we really should do a whole show on this. It's tough to tease out in kids whether or not you've got a strong-willed child and when and if at all it gets into this whole other world of this thing called oppositional defiant disorder. And usually there are signs of defiance in the child or hostility towards authority figures. And these are tend to be persistent problems that go on for at least 6 months and are disruptive to the family, to the school environment, and really cause problems in those settings and for the child.
Yeah, you know, those with oppositional defiant disorder, these are kind of a range of mood disorders called conduct disorders. And it can be very, very difficult, just as Christy mentioned, because a child with this can lose their temper easily, will certainly blame others and will pit family members sometimes against others. And will really irritate people around them very, very easily. So they'll be very socially isolated, which actually makes then this problem even worse.
And it also can have some overlap with other diagnoses like attention deficit disorder or ADHD, anxiety or depression. And so having an evaluation from a doctor and involving a child psychologist can be helpful to make sure that, you know, your child has a full evaluation and really understand what you're faced with.
Yeah, and this is going to really require a team approach because children with this disorder are at risk for all kinds of other problems as well, including alcohol and substance use and a risk of suicide and harmful behaviors can be very high. And then the family discord that this can cause and even leading to sometimes parents needing to get divorced because one parent gets pitted against the other, one parent's the bad parent. And so really getting some great psychological support and then coming up with a really good plan, which involves a multidisciplinary team approach to support you and your child in an ongoing management.
Yeah, the treatment usually includes both individual and family therapy to help the child and the parents learn skills to problem solve and to move forward.
But I think you're right. I think we, Christy, we should really devote a whole show to understanding this condition better because I think it's an important one that probably affects a lot of people and people are even scared a little bit to talk about it. So let's commit to trying to do something about that in the future. Julie, what's our next house call?
I came in to see my doctor not too long ago for chest pain. When I was there, she said that she thought my pain could be coming from stress. She asked about my life and stress, and we discussed that my stress is really coming from a husband who yells at me much of the time. He has even hit me once or twice over the last 10 years when he was drunk. Just talking about this experience with my family physician was helpful, and I wanted to share that with you.
Wow.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us, because I think hearing that will actually help many listeners understand things that they know really all too common and which occurs still all too frequently.
And it really speaks to the relationship that, that clearly you have with your family physician and how important that can be to help you get the resources that you need and be able to acknowledge what's going on. I certainly hope that, that your family physician talked to you about these things, but would hope that you you are aware and reach out to some resources that could be helpful to you, particularly if he is drinking a lot. There's a resource called Al-Anon, which is for families dealing with family members, husbands or spouses or children or other people in the family who have problems with alcohol.
And then in terms of the domestic violence here, which is that's what it is, domestic violence here. You know, statewide, there's the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And then locally, there's the Orange County Family Violence Prevention Program. And their telephone number is 866-929-7122. And you certainly could get in touch with them because you really do need some support here because you're already, you know, you're not only has this occurred for a long time, you're having chest pain now.
Right.
And that's really, really impacting your health in ways that could, that are really dangerous for you.
There's also the Beacon program at UNC as well. But definitely want to encourage you to get the support that you need.
And your family physician and primary care doctor is a great start for that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing.
Julie, what's our next house call?
I want to change my life for the better now that I am 50. I'm a high-powered executive male, and I know I'm overweight at 240 pounds, and I don't exercise much. I have a slightly elevated blood pressure, about 150 over 94, but I really feel great overall. I don't smoke at all, and I rarely drink alcohol. What three things should I do to most improve my health?
Well, first of all, good for you that you're motivated, and good for you that you don't smoke. Those are major steps.
Yeah, and, you know, Christy and I have talked about on the show before about people's perceptions about their health, and so I can't, you know, I have to comment on the fact that, you know, you actually might be more than overweight. You might be obese, and is that a perception issue of understanding risks there in terms of how much weight? And the other thing is, you said you have a slightly elevated blood pressure. And so I wonder, Christy, is the perception here that because I feel good at age 50, I actually am in good health? And I'm not so certain that you're in such good health.
Sure. So you asked about three things. I mean, one of them for sure would be to lose weight. So depending on your height, most likely 240 pounds is in the obese category. And so losing weight to get that into a normal range category would be really important.
Trying to get down a half a pound a week probably is going to take you a year or 2 years to get down to a really kind of an ideal weight, even if you're doing it really well.
And you mentioned that you don't exercise. That would be the second thing I'd encourage you to do, is to start exercising most days of the week to get some walking or some jogging in. Most people say start slow and work your way up.
Yeah, I would have, Christy, I would have said the three things you could do was exercise,
yeah,
and exercise.
Well, exercise would help you lose weight, and also with your blood pressure.
This slightly elevated blood pressure.
Yeah, that needs attention. Yeah. It really does. So I would have you go in, talk to your doctor about all these things, and you probably need to go ahead and start on medication for that blood pressure while you're working on losing the weight.
Yeah. Okay. Julie, what's our very last house call?
I recently had a sore throat, and my doctor diagnosed strep throat. When he gave me a prescription for antibiotics, he told me that the medicine actually has little impact on my sore throat, but it is given to prevent rheumatic fever. I've never heard that before. Is it true? In that case, do I really need the antibiotics? Because isn't rheumatic fever really rare?
Great question. And yes, it's true that your body might fight off the strep throat on its own. And yes, it's true that you need the antibiotics.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, one of the things, though, most people do think that they take the antibiotics to get rid of the strep throat. And it is true that you will get rid of your strep throat a little bit sooner by taking the antibiotics than if you don't. But one of the major reasons, and your doctor was correct, is really if you don't take it and you have strep throat, you can get rheumatic fever. And one of the reasons why rheumatic fever is rare is because we treat strep throats with antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if we saw a case of rheumatic fever today, we would say, boy, where did we go wrong on something we could have prevented?
Absolutely. So hopefully that answered some of your questions. We've talked a little bit about strep throat and rheumatic fever, about making lifestyle changes to lose weight and become more healthy.
You can do to get support if you have a child with oppositional defiant disorder, as well as what you can do to get support if you are being a victim of domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing those with us today and for joining us on Here's to Your Health.
We hope we've addressed those issues that are important to you, and that you'll share your own questions and experiences. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/HTYH.
And we'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our producer Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. John Saltz. We hope you'll join us next time on Here's to Your Health.
On behalf of UNC Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Here's to Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website at 1360WCHL.com and click on WCHL On Demand. Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine at News Talk 1360 WCHL.